radioalburn.com.
Welcome to Truth Without Radio. Today's date is Friday the 14th of February 2020 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting live tonight at radioalbion.com because we have with us the producer of Adolf Hitler, the greatest story never told, Communism by the Back Door, the Freemasonic victory of World War II and the soon to be released Churchill's body count. Mr. Dennis Wise, did I get that last bit right? Body count?
Well, that's, yeah.
Death count?
Yeah, it wasn't far away, was it?
Hard work remembering all of that. How are you doing, sir, anyway?
Well, I haven't had a great week, but I have had an interesting week, to be honest. I took a trip around YouTube. I usually do like, and I'll put in Adolf Hitler, the greatest story never told, just to see what's going on. And I noticed our friends have put plenty of fake videos up there trying to put people off, even trying to look for it. There's one or two videos up there asking where it's gone and why have YouTube banned it, and others replying to it with other videos. But one interesting one was a fake one that they put up. They said it was in conjunction with Dennis Wise, and it was the biggest load of crap you could ever wish for. And along the way, it said something on the lines of Dennis Wise, born such and such a date, died 2019, which is, if that's not hate speech, I don't know what isn't. But at least I know I'm getting to them.
Well, yeah, definitely. If they're trying to, you know, make fake stuff up and attribute it to you, try and use your name to put across black propaganda. Yep. And that, you must be over the target there. I did notice there was an app that was being advertised for removing all the mainstream rubbish from YouTube, all the BBC, all the Sky, all the mainstream media. There's some app. I'm not sure it's on Firefox or Chrome. Yeah, and it will remove it from all your search results. And try to fix the algorithms. I mean, it used to be a proper democracy, didn't it, YouTube? Whatever was the most watched video got to the top of the ratings. And now it's all
soon,
fixed.
Yeah, soon change their minds.
Unbelievable. And it's also the anniversary of Dresden, isn't it? And they had that on the television. Did you catch any of that recently on the news?
Yes, they had that incredible low number of 25,000 killed.
Unbelievable, that, isn't it? I mean, it's good that they actually mentioned it. They said that there was lots of questions whether it was the right thing to do, but they still minimized it, I think.
Well, they had a
damage.
Survivor from the a British survivor who was in the camps at the time, and he said he was ashamed to be British that night.
I think not just him, but I think most British people were ashamed to be British once they'd heard what had happened. And, you know, they really didn't talk about the horror of it, of how people's bodies were melting. I mean, because they were talking about people escaping from it on the BBC. But how do you escape from a flaming inferno like that, a whirlwind where people are literally being sucked into the flames and they're just turning into ashes in seconds? I mean, it's like a nuclear holocaust almost, wasn't it?
And there's no guessing who was behind that one.
Yes, and we're going to be talking about him in the First World War tonight. We're going to be talking about the Gallipoli campaign and Winston Churchill in that. What made you want to do this one next, Dennis?
Well, it's just, I get this either Monday or Tuesday. I start on you'll see what's around and see what comes up and what catches my eye. And obviously that was one which he was, again, privy to. So why not?
Well, there's a wealth of incidences that you can go into with Winston Churchill, isn't there? I mean, just look. Go on.
It annoys me when I saw, I think it was a YouTube advert, and the writing on it was saying, the title was, why did all the war criminals escape to Argentina? And by this day and age, what people know, they must surely know that with every Nazi outside of Europe, there were still enough war criminals in there on the other side but it's never mentioned, and it's really frustrating.
Well, they did sort of say that Dresden was a war crime, and
sort of.
Yeah, but they, you know, they didn't say anything about why it wasn't tried as a war crime. They were just saying today that it could possibly have been a war crime to kill all those civilians. And of course, that was just Churchill all over, wasn't it? He was Mr. War Crime, right from the Lusitania right the way up till Dresden. And this time, it wasn't actually a war crime. It was just a complete fiasco that ended up with lots and lots of dead people. And wounded people.
Yeah, at that time it was the biggest military defeat. But I think you were going to even outdo that in World War II.
Yeah, the biggest military disaster in all of British history, and Churchill was responsible for it. And they have tried to whitewash it. I mean, when you look it up on Wikipedia, they say, "Oh, Churchill was absolved of the blame," but he was the leader of the fleet, wasn't he? He was the admiral of the navy.
Yeah, and he was demoted as well after.
Yeah, but he still managed to come back again.
Well, I think what it is, I've worked it out really. There's only a certain amount of people who can do what Churchill and Stalin do. And so once they've qualified for the job, I think they find it hard to get rid of them because it's not that easy to find a mass murderer on that scale.
Well, it's it, isn't it? They're psychopaths, just total psychopaths with no concern for the people dying, whether it's on their side or whether it's on the other side, it just doesn't seem to matter to you.
Doesn't matter.
And you think about this one. I mean, we were talking earlier about the figures of the numbers killed and wounded, and first off, it comes to 150,000 dead and wounded, and you know that it's going to be a lot more than that. And then you look on Wikipedia, and it tells you, well, in actual fact, it was 500,000 on each side that was a casualty, so wounded. Yep. So, well, or 250,000 on each side. So half a million, it says, that were wounded there. So you know it's going to be even more than that, just from this one campaign.
Exactly.
To achieve nothing. And instead of burying his head in shame and disappearing from public life, he's trying to get back into Parliament again at the end of it.
Either as a Liberal or shame. A Tory. Don't really matter.
Well, yeah, I was also reading that even when he was a Tory, the Tories didn't like him because he kept voting Liberal. He kept supporting the Liberals. You know, that reminds me of Peter Hammond and John Bercow and all those recent traitor Tories that were supporting Labour and staying within the European Union. It just shows that it's
left,
not new.
Under Cameron, that was probably the left of most that the Tories have ever been.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, just Tory in name only, weren't they?
Yeah, that's right.
Right, well, let's get into the Gallipoli campaign then. If we've got time at the end of it, we'll go into the starvation of Germany, because I know you wanted to cover that as well. But this Gallipoli campaign, there's quite a lot to it. By the end of 1914, the situation on the Western Front had stagnated into trench warfare and ground warfare. Britain was used to being a naval power and had already fought successful battles against the German navy, but was now out of her element, being stuck in a land war. And remember, Britain was known for ruling the sea, and the British navy was just unsurpassed. So do you know anything about the battles that they had against the German navy? What do you know what the German navy was like at all, Dennis?
Not so much of World War One. No, I mean, they were a military power, and funnily enough, we were talking about when he destroyed the French fleet last couple of weeks ago. The Germans, when after Versailles, they were told to give up their navy, and they scuttled everything, if you remember. But as far as battles go, I'm not sure about World War One.
Well, the Germans had the U-boats, didn't they? And I think they sort of surpassed what Britain had. They were caught by surprise by that. Really, I think the British were. By the U-boats, but I guess by the end of the war they would have caught up. But apparently they did have a few battles, but by this time everything was in the trenches and there wasn't much use for the navy. And of course then you've got Winston Churchill, who is the first Lord of the Admiralty, and in January 1915 he proposed a plan to bring the navy back into the fight, with the Ottomans being on Germany's side and fighting against Russia. The Russians had formally requested supplies from the British, and Churchill came up with a plan for opening a new route to the Black Sea from the Aegean, and this was to achieve two objectives. First, to provide assistance to Russia, and secondly, to prevent the Ottomans from entering the war on the side of Germany, and in doing so, he also hoped to encourage neutral nations such as Greece to enter the war on Britain's side. Now, I've had a look at the map here, and we've also got Bulgaria there, we've got the Balkans there. Do you know what was sort of happening in that area at the time, Dennis? Were they just all neutral? Were any of them on the side of Germany, or what was happening?
In the Balkans?
Yeah, because it's all around that area, isn't it? Because you've got Turkey Serbia, there.
I believe it was the Black Hand, a Masonic secret sect of Serbia, which killed Ferdinand of Austria. And that started the war off. Austria obviously declared war on Serbia. So it was kicking off in the Balkans from the very get-go. And then Germany came in because Russia was going to, obviously, has always been an ally of Serbia, historically. And Russia was going to come in. So Germany came in on the side of Austria because of Russia coming in. But unfortunately, Germany was the one who was tainted with the brush of starting the war, which was probably the most ridiculous decision ever made.
So you got Turkey on the one side, you got Serbia on the other, you've got a route that goes through to Constantinople, or Istanbul as it's called now, and that's the Dardanelles. And what Churchill was planning on doing was going up there through the Dardanelles and going across that little bit of Turkey so that he could get to Russia. Is that yeah. correct? Right, so that's
that about right, the plan. Yeah.
That was the plan. And this plan, which had only just sort of entered Churchill's head at the beginning of January, that was approved within 1 month. And it was estimated that it would also only take 1 month for it to succeed. And they thought that all they would need was the Navy, basically. They didn't think they would need that much to do this. And you've got to bear in mind that all of that land there is occupied by the Turks, or it was the Ottoman Empire at the time, wasn't it? It hadn't actually become Turkey yet. Because this is the other thing.
Yeah.
This is the other thing. The unintended consequences of this was that Turkey formed as a country. So you could say that Churchill was responsible, or partially responsible, for Turkey. Instead of the Ottoman Empire just falling apart at the end of the war. I do wonder if maybe that plays into why there seems to be this support for Turkey joining the European Union. And Boris Johnson is very pro-Turkish, and Theresa May was very pro-Turkish.
I've got my own thoughts on that one. That's just another few more million Muslims entering legally.
Well, that as well, but I'm also wondering if there isn't some sort of pride there, some misplaced pride on the part of the British establishment that they, you know, sort of unintentionally helped Turkey to form as a country. You know, there might be.
At this moment in time, we are paying, the European Union is paying Turkey to stop the influx coming in of immigrants. So Turkey's quite happy to do that while they're getting paid. But to bring Turkey in would bring a mass of Muslims in on top, who would then be able to go and live wherever they wanted across Europe.
Well, I know they support that. I know they support that. So basically, we've got this plan that's just entered Churchill's head. It gets okayed within a month. They haven't really scoped the place out. There's no real thought gone into it. And the operation begins a month later. And the plan was for a joint British and French fleet to take the Dardanelles Strait and then move onwards to Constantinople. And I don't think there was any idea there of liberating Constantinople from the Muslims.
No,
I don't think that played into it.
So.
I mean, at least that would have been some kind of reasoning for it, but that doesn't seem to appear anywhere. And also they were hoping by doing this that they would prevent Bulgaria from joining the war on Germany's side. So I guess what they were thinking was this is going to be a big show of strength, a big show of British strength, and the Bulgarians will want to join us. And nobody else will want to join Germany after this. So this was the plan. But what actually happened when they got there, the Turks sunk three battleships and damaged seven others out of the fleet, which meant that 10 ships were actually knocked out of a total of 18. So 10 ships were put out of action out of the original 18. And this was thanks to the Turkish naval mines and their long-range shore cannons. And the minesweepers, as well as battleships on the British side, were needed to neutralise them. But as the ships went forward, they would hit the mines. And as the sweepers went forward, they would be shot at.
Yep.
And this went on for 2 months. And in 9 out of 11 trips, the sweepers had to retreat from being shot at. So they basically hadn't thought about this at all. And you've got the Turks that are on the shore and they're up nice and high and they've got their guns there and they're just firing out at sea. And yep. And they're also surrounded by mines. I mean, Churchill must have just, you know, not thought, well, they might have actually mined this area.
I don't think Churchill gives much thought to much, really.
So this went on for 2 months with this total failure. And then they decided that they would change the strategy. They would charge the shore. The strategy was a complete failure. And by April, the British opted to begin landing troops on the shore. This included the British 29th Division, the Australian and New Zealand Army Corps that we know better as the ANZAC, and some French forces with Senegalese troops landing on the Asian shore to provide a diversion. And this is really, when you hear about non-white troops that were being used during the war, this idea that they try and tell us now, it was for things like this, to provide a diversion.
Yeah, that's right.
And also to bring supplies. None of them were actually on the front line doing anything, you know, really heroic and courageous. They were just being used in instances like this. And then what we see then in your video, we see footage of the troops charging the shore. Now, is this actually from Gallipoli, that footage?
Yeah, well, can I just take you back just a second of that footage? You actually see them arriving in rowing boats.
Yeah, well, that's what it comes up with the narrative next. It says, from high on the steep slopes, the Turkmen fire on the Europeans with total impunity. They are well-armed, well-equipped and well-commanded by Mustafa Kemal, the future leader and moderniser of Turkey. But the mission was a complete disaster. The Europeans arrived in rowing boats and after suffering heavy casualties, found themselves dug into trenches the same as they were on the Western Front, and not even able to make it up the beach. And they were stuck like this for another 8 months with no successful attacks made.
Yeah, it kind of brings it to memory when Nelson or someone like that in them days had row ashore, you know, to an island. I mean, to do such a thing, I mean, it was just crazy, especially when the machine guns are around.
Well, is that what we were seeing then? When we see the footage? And that was actually taken at the time, was it?
Yes, that was the footage, the rowing boats.
So did they have like news companies that were embedded with them to film this triumphant charge up the beach?
Oh, yeah, they had reporters there, and filming.
And did they get extra troops in for that? Or was it just the Navy, or what happened there?
Well, I think they brought the New Zealand and Australians in, didn't they, for this? And I can remember seeing a poster asking for volunteers in England, saying that you need it out there. So you know, definitely wanted to send troops back out there.
And when you think of when they go up the beach, these amphibian landings, you think they have these proper boats that they charge up onto the beach with it, and the front opens up, and all the squaddies charge out with their bayonets fixed at the end of the rifles, and there was none of that. It looked like lifeboats, didn't it? Rowing to the beach.
That's exactly what it looked like, yeah, lifeboats. I've got a poster in front of me here that says, "Get into khaki. Your comrades at Gallipoli are calling you. This is not for the time for football and tennis matches. It is serious. Show that you realise this by enlisting at once." It is not football or tennis. It certainly wasn't.
We need cannon fodder. I mean, that's what it's saying, basically, isn't it? You can just imagine them getting out of the boats, and they're trying to pull the boats up onto the beach, and they're just getting fired upon, getting knocked out like flies. And then what happens? They end up digging pits, and they end up down the trenches, and they're in exactly the same position that they were in on the west at the Western Front, which is what Churchill was trying to change, if you remember. Exactly. I mean, that's why he wanted to bring the Navy in, because once you're in those trenches, it's very hard for anybody to win, because you're just stuck there under the ground, locked in, can't move, you can't advance, and you're just picking one another off, basically.
Disease kicks in then.
Well, yeah, disease certainly kicked in here. But you also had these machine gun turrets and all these guns that they had at the top of the beach. Because if you imagine that the Turks are up high, and and the European troops are all down low, and they're all the European troops are all at the bottom of a slope. So I mean, whatever comes down from above is just going to land on those troops, isn't it? It's the worst situation to be in.
I noticed in that footage when the rowing boats landed, they were, it just showed, I was looking at one particular rowing boat, and they were getting out of the rowing boat, and there were two or three shot dead even before they got on the sand.
Yeah, you see them falling. You know, I mean, this was a disaster, a total disaster. What goes through their minds thinking, well, yeah, we'll just charge the beach in these wooden rowing boats, when they know they've been fired upon by artillery? And yet they think that these wooden rowing boats are going to protect them.
Well, I think that upper class thing comes in as well, because like you said, I don't think they're particularly bothered about amount of death, really, just whether or not, you know, there's a public kickback on it. If not, then they're quite happy to keep throwing them at them.
Well, this did look really bad, didn't it? I mean, they did have an inquiry afterwards. They had two inquiries afterwards. And, you know, it did look terrible. And, you know, they did find people to blame. It was just that they didn't, they made sure that they kept Churchill out of it, basically. I mean, it didn't look good. I'll have to ask Mr. I about this next time that I interview him.
Yeah, I'd be interested in all myself what he thinks,
yeah. Yeah, all of these things that you've been bringing up about Churchill. Yeah. It would be good to find out just how much the British public knew about this at the time, or did it not come out until after the war?
Probably not. That's my feeling.
So they're basically in the trenches again. Now, the Anzacs were actually able to advance once during the whole stalemate, but then they were quickly repelled. Now, I find it quite interesting with these Anzacs, because this is the worst military defeat in the whole of British history, and it was a defeat also for Australian and New Zealand history. But they have Anzacs Day, and they honour a day in remembrance of this disaster, basically. I think
what the celebration is that for the first time they're called into action as a country, and they're felt to have given a pretty heroic account of themselves, and so they celebrate that fact and not the fact that it was a disaster.
Yeah, because this helped to put them on the stage as, right, we're separate countries, we've got our own army, we helped you guys out there in Europe, even if this went terribly, tragically wrong. Yeah. So besides being in the wooden boats and being shot at and then being in the trenches, on top of that, due to the rocky terrain, it was impossible to bury the dead, and conditions deteriorated very quickly due to the corpses beginning to rot after being left out in the hot summer sun, because by now it's June, July. This attracted the flies, which infected the drinking water and led to outbreaks of disease. And I think those numbers that we've got of the injured, a large portion of them are actually sick and ill with disease that they had caught from the toxic conditions that they were living in. It wasn't just the fact that they were in these trenches, it was the fact they had all these dead bodies that they couldn't bury.
They couldn't get rid of, yeah.
And maybe that's not something you think about, really, but when we used to have these battles in times gone by, you know, you'd have a big pile of corpses that would have to be got rid of at the end of each day. You'd have to have a break in the fighting just so that you could bury the corpses. So it, you wouldn't all end up getting ill.
I also read somewhere that there was, because of the hot weather at one point, the artillery fire from the Turks would set off fires, and there were actually some soldiers burnt to death because they couldn't get away from the fire for whatever reason. So there are numerous ways that people were dying, as well as disease, you know.
And once again, they had no idea of even what the terrain was. I don't think they even had any maps.
No, that's what it says, yeah.
Absolute big-headedness, basically. You know, they thought, we're the British, we rule the seas, we've got the British Empire, we can do anything. And yep. That was the mentality. Because you would have thought that somebody would have said, well, hang on a minute, Churchill, you know, maybe this isn't such a good plan. You know, the people pointed out that this wasn't such a good plan to go and attack the French Navy. But I guess that was later on, wasn't it? That was another 40 years on.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's another.
You know, they probably learned from situations like this that, well, yeah, maybe we should speak up, and maybe the admirals and the officials had learned by that time, well, maybe we should listen to what the crew are telling us.
Maybe.
In some instances. Because they did learn from this, apparently.
Yeah, well, they learned with the landings, didn't they, in 44, whenever it were.
Due to the close proximity of the Turkish guns, the Europeans were unable to rotate troops on and off the front line. And when they did eventually retreat in December, they had to do so in a segmented fashion to avoid being blasted by the Muslims. So you imagine that as well. I mean, you're stuck in that trench and that's it. You're stuck. At least on the Western Front, what they were able to do is rotate people from the front but then back to the back again and keep rotating them so that they did move about and they
freshen
were in different, different trenches, ones that weren't so damp. But these guys were just stuck there. The ones that were at the front that managed to make it past the first machine gun fire when they got out of the lifeboat, that was it. They dug themselves a hole and they were stuck in it. Almost like digging your own grave, isn't it?
More or less, would have been for a lot.
It says, this retreat was the only example of any intelligent strategic thinking in the entirety of the campaign, a campaign that was supposed to be a big surprise move. So don't forget, this was supposed to be impressing the Bulgarians and terrifying the Turks, and all it did was make the British look extremely foolish. Since by the end of it, 44,000 Allied troops and 85,000 Ottoman troops had lost their lives. Now, as you say, there's some question over this, isn't there? I mean, what was the total that you came to earlier, Dennis?
Well, I came to around 150,000. Then I found 187,000, and you found even more after that, didn't you?
Yeah, well, 500,000 I found. 250,000 on each side, and that was supposedly the casualties as well as the people that had died. But you know, I think possibly there were probably more Ottoman troops because I mean,
they say there were more Ottoman troops killed, but I find that hard to believe when they were up in the out of sight.
Maybe that's just bravado. I
mean, yeah, probably.
How do they get? Because
they won
numbers?
That. They actually won that battle as well. So,
well, they're very, very proud of it. Rightly so, you know, taking on the British Empire and the best of Australia and New Zealand and sending them packing, basically.
Yeah, I find it hard to believe they lost more. I really do.
Churchill was demoted and the defeat went down as the worst ever in all British military history and the second worst defeat ever in Australian history. I mean, that's a lot of history in British military history for this to be the worst possible defeat. And yet Churchill was still put forward as leading us into war against Adolf Hitler, even after this absolute catastrophe that he'd been involved in. And I guess this was just a few years after the Lusitania, wasn't it?
It would have been, yeah, no doubt. So he's sleeping well, though. I'll give him that.
I think there must have been a movement against him. There must have been people that weren't happy with him. It's just that
they possibly were, but
out.
I think a lot of it were covered up. I think that's the problem. When you control the press, you know, you can keep a lot out of people's way.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It seems to have been airbrushed out of history. The same as the people that were objecting to going to war against Hitler. There was a massive movement against going to war, and we're just not told about that now, and we're not told about Regulation 18B, where they locked so many people up. And what they actually did at the time when they locked up the nationalists that were opposed to the war, they then put it about in the media that these people were all traitors and that Oswald Mosley was a traitor. And there was nothing to show that they were traitors. They had all said, You know, if we go to war, we will fight for Britain and we will fight to the last man, the same as we did in the first war. But we don't think going to war is the right answer. That was all they were saying. But it was presented to the general public that these people were traitors.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've spoken to like elderly people, and that was the impression that they got.
Well, there's also this thing about fascism as well, because obviously they were classed as fascists. But I noticed that Mussolini had kicked out all the mafia. This is because fascism is such a bad thing that the mafia had to leave. And so when World War II started, the US government, when they were going to invade Europe, they asked for the mafia's help. So they're asking for these gangland murderers' help to invade Sicily and Italy. So it just goes to show, you know, that this government is quite prepared to work hand in hand with gangsters and murderers, whereas the fascist governments got rid of them.
Well, the British government, particularly the Tories, they were quite impressed with Mussolini at first. They were on very good terms with him, and the march on Rome and the changes that he was making in Italy. And it was just what once the war started and he'd allied with Hitler that they really sort of turned on Mussolini. And up until that point, I mean, all these countries were nationalist. But after fighting against Hitler, suddenly nationalism became a bad thing. We have to be as different from that as we possibly can be. But every country was like that. I mean, Britain was fiercely patriotic. If you read any of the history books from the 18th, 19th, early 20th century, and the people that are writing it, you know, they wouldn't be out of place writing on an alt-right or white nationalist website today. It's all talk about the courageous race that we come from, all about our ancestors. It's all about the breeding. It all changed after the Second World War, and nationalism suddenly became a bad thing.
Because it's communism instead.
Yeah. Because communism won.
Correct.
Well, let's have a look at what actually went wrong with this plan. The plan was that just the sheer presence of the British military would be enough to cause the Turks to capitulate, since before this, the country was known as the sick man of Europe. But to think that some minor British military action would be enough to terrify them was sheer hubris. I find this interesting. Because, you know, you would look at Turkey today and you'd say, well, it's nothing to do with Europe. They're not Europeans. They're obviously not Europeans. Yeah. And yet back then they were calling it the sick man of Europe. And actually, if you look at some of these Turks, you know, they could pass for white. They don't look that dark skinned. Especially if you look at Boris Johnson, he's part Turkish.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't look very dark skinned. I don't know if they've, you know, become darker since then. I know you could, if you look at the pictures of the Moors going back 700-800 years, they don't look dark like the Arabs do today and the Berbers. You might see the odd black face, black slave, but pictures of the Moors themselves, they're not depicted as dark as they are today. I think they have got darker, and there probably were more white men among them years ago.
Mm.
Well, and also with the white slaves that they used to take, didn't they? A lot of white women that they used to breed with years back. And I guess these would have just been called the Ottomans. I don't think they were called Turks. Were they called Turkmen before it was Turkey?
No.
Well, the Turkey itself was called Turkey after Ataturk, this Kemal Ataturk, who was actually leading the Ottoman Empire against the British Navy. The guy that was actually on the beach leading them, he is the father of the Turkish nation today.
That's right.
John Bourne, do you know who John Bourne is? Not the Telegraph journalist, but it just says in your video that the person talking is John Bourne.
Yeah, he's just given a seminar, isn't it? Must be some kind of expert on it.
Well, John Bourne had this to say. The reason the British thought fighting the Ottoman Empire was a good idea is the belief that it was a completely rotten state with a hopeless army that only had to be kicked to make it collapse, just like the rotting door on a farm building. And I guess it was a pretty rotten state. But the situation of charging the beach in wooden lifeboats when you've got mounted gun turrets at the top of the beach, I mean, even if you have got a completely rotten state with a hopeless army, they're still going to be in the best position and they're still going to be likely to beat you, aren't they? And this was a ridiculous plan.
In World War II, they had these specially made landing crafts, didn't they, which protected you up to a point. But in a rowing boat, that's just 18th century, isn't it?
Yeah, the plan was doomed to fail, regardless of how good the army was. I mean, you probably wouldn't have needed that many people up there. Just, you know, manning the guns, if you've got these people down below. And what it reminds me of is Monty Python and the quest for the Holy Grail when they're outside the castle and you've got the Frenchman up there. Remember he's saying, I spit on you and all of this, and they're up nice and high. So, you know, the Monty Python guys can't get at them because they're up high. There's only two of them up there.
Yeah, I never watched a lot of Monty Python, but yeah, one or two spring to mind.
And the Ottomans had been doing very well fighting the Russians in the Caucasus, and now they had the advantage of fighting on and for their home territory. And there was absolutely no evidence that a few British naval destroyers would change their mind about their status in the war. See, this was the other factor. This was a direct attack on Turkey. This was a direct attack on the Ottoman land. Not like, you know, it's somewhere else. Yep. These guys are fighting for their families. They don't want to be taken over by the British.
Which is always an extra incentive.
The British had neglected to plan properly, only taking a month to approve the operation and at first thinking it would only need the Navy. The amphibious assault was tacked on later, also with no planning, and due to where the British naval bombardment was coming from, it was obvious to the Muslims where the British landings would be taking place. I mean, that's ridiculous, isn't it? They send off those Senegalese troops to go and land somewhere else while they're, while they head straight off from the battleships, and the Muslims can just see where the battleships are with their binoculars. I mean, that's...
it's Christmas time, isn't it?
Well, no, when they did this, the plan that they did was in January, wasn't it? But this attack was much later.
It was Eid.
Compare this to Operation Overlord in 1944. Years of planning and deception went into making this a success, and that was very likely due to lessons learned from the completely absent planning that went into the Gallipoli debacle. And I guess, you know, Operation Overlord, that's the American term for D-Day, landings, because, you know, that's the same thing, wasn't it, landing these boats on the beach?
That's the same thing.
So... that was really a chance of putting right this catastrophe in Gallipoli, wasn't it?
Although, if you remember, they had a bit of a thing themselves when a couple of U-boats turned up when they were practicing down on the English coast.
Yeah, you remind me of that. I mean, I remember us talking about it, but I don't remember the details.
Yeah, they were practicing with live ammunition. And so a lot of Americans were accidentally shot. And the two U-boats were travelling along and saw what was happening, and obviously it was Christmas again.
Yeah, that was savage. Yeah, and there's a memorial to them, isn't it? All these people.
Yeah, and we kept quiet for years.
Died by friendly fire. I mean, again, what sort of planning goes into that? Well, we'll just practice with live ammunition against our friends, against our allies.
Yeah. Again, there's no real care about the mass population, is there?
No. Well, there was unintended consequences from this. It was supposed to break the cycle of trench warfare, but it ended up being the worst example of it of all, due to the near criminal mistakes made by its commanders. So again, you would think maybe there would be some charges against the people that planned this for the reckless endangerment of British life.
Yeah, well, it just depends really how many orders were coming straight down from above. I mean, okay, some generals may have made their own decisions, but I'm not convinced they were all their own general decision. You know, Churchill's up there saying do this and do that with every other incident that we got.
Also, I mean, think of the irony of this. You know, they're talking about how, you know, they're going to show the Germans and they're going to show the rest of the world how we can still use the Navy. Everybody else is stuck in their trench warfare, but we know better. We can get the Navy doing something, and the whole Navy ends up being stuck in the trenches as well. What an embarrassment.
Yeah, it makes you wonder how they wonder what, well, I suppose they wonder why America came in. But I mean, you can understand why America would need it to come in.
Well, you can see why the Jews said, well, we're the ones that are going to help you win the war. It's if we come in on your side, then you'll win the war. And if you want us to come in on your side, you've got to give us Palestine. That was the deal, wasn't it? And then they got the Balfour Declaration.
Yep.
And that's what old Benjamin Friedman told us all, wasn't it? Wasn't he there? Wasn't he one of the people that were there when they were doing the Balfour?
That's right. Yeah, it was privy to it all. And Lord Balfour was a good friend of Rothschild's, part of the Masonic setup that Rothschild had with all the others, Kitchener and all the others.
And you can also see the amount or the extent of Jewish involvement when the Versailles Treaty was being signed. And every single country that was present there, every politician had a Jewish advisor.
Yeah, the 170 Jews were there.
Amazing. 170 Jewish advisors. And then the rest of the world wonders why nobody actually benefited out of the Versailles Treaty. Somebody must have done.
And most of the advisors were really, I thought it was the other way around. It was 170 Jews taking their Wilsons and their prime ministers and all the puppets with them.
And that's why you ended up with Germany being ruined at the end of it, Germany being blamed for it, and all the conditions being set up for it to continue 40 years later, 30 years later. And the rest of Europe just couldn't believe it. What the hell? I thought this was the war to end all wars, and now you're telling us we've got to go to war again?
Yep. Even worse one than the first one.
Yeah, there was no public support for it at all. It was all just ginned up by the bankers and the mainstream media.
Yep.
Well, the biggest impact of the campaign was in shaping the national identities of the countries involved in it. Mustafa Kemal went on to give his name Ataturk to the new country he founded after the Ottoman collapse, and the Anzacs became a source of great pride for Australia and New Zealand. So neither of those things were an objective. But that's why I was saying, you know, maybe Churchill could say that he was inadvertently responsible for the country Turkey forming after the war, because it was all because this Mustafa Kemal defeated the British Navy that he made such a big name for himself, and all those Ottomans in that area coagulated around him, and they made him their leader and their hero, and he revolutionized the country and modernized it. He sort of decoupled it from the through Islam. This is why a lot of these Turks don't like Erdogan, because they say he's going back to the Ottomans, because Mustafa Kemal was a progressive and he was trying to like liberalize things, and now you've got Erdogan who wants to go back to literalist Islam.
Yeah.
And
scant consolation, if that's all what came out of it.
Yeah, legalizing child marriage and things like that, which, you know, a lot of Turkey don't actually want. But there is a strong Islamist contingent there now.
Sure there is.
And the war would continue for another 2 years, with this being possibly the most pointless loss of life that happened during the entire period. What an embarrassment. But I guess the Turks are very proud of it, aren't they? We caused the British Empire to retreat.
Everybody out of that way. Yeah, they'll be the ones.
Yeah, we just handed it to them on a plate.
Well, I was never taught anything like this at school. I dare say you wasn't. So most people, you know, wouldn't really know about it unless they looked into it.
Well, I've heard the name Gallipoli, but I didn't know what actually went on.
Yeah,
there.
Well, that's it. Yeah, you don't really get taught what happened at these events.
You don't even know whether it was embarrassing for us or whether it was a big victory for us. You just know that it was something that happened
in the past. To wait till Hollywood makes a movie, then you catch up on it, and even then it's not true.
Yeah, well, I think Hollywood really likes to make Churchill out to be a wonderful, great hero. So they probably wouldn't want there to be a movie of Gallipoli. But if it hadn't been Churchill, I'm sure they would love to show the non-whites defeating the Europeans. They'd love that.
There may well be one, but if there is, it certainly won't be accusing Churchill of any wrong.
Yeah, they would play down his role and blame Asquith or somebody else that was
Anybody but Winston.
Then we've got the media response, and we've got the British war correspondent for the Daily Telegraph. He was there, and this is a quote from him. He said, "It is the most ghastly military fiasco in our history. The generals had no maps and a vague idea of the nature of the ground in their front, and no adequate steps were taken to keep the troops supplied. The Australian volunteers have nothing to drink under a beating sun." So on top of that, on top of all the rotting bodies and the heat, they had nothing to eat or drink either. They must have just been stuck there in those trenches for 8 months with nothing on the beach.
It must have been terrible.
Horrific. 3 months later, the same cameraman films the men starving and feverish. So maybe he managed to get back out there to the boats or something. Or was he embedded with them and living with them? Did you show the film, you know, the two little different clips of film? Because it just tells us that the cameraman is filming them starving and feverish 3 months later.
I didn't see any film, but he did tell us, yeah.
Did you find out any more about him at all?
No, I didn't go down that route.
He said, "They know that 150,000 men have been killed or wounded here in vain." So he claims 150,000 men killed or wounded, and Wikipedia says it was 250,000 on each side. But just the fact that they knew that had happened, and they knew that it was all in vain, it was all absolutely pointless. Their deaths were completely pointless, and they knew that. So that must have really damaged morale. Because, I mean, what was the point in securing a beach in Turkey?
A long way from home.
Yeah. And then it says, "Bulgaria has swung over to the German side and the Dardanelles remain in Turkish hands." So instead of being this great big victory for British might that would ensure the Bulgarians came in on the side of Britain in the war, it basically did the exact opposite and they came in on the side of Germany.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if we've actually got our Bulgarian listener in the chat room tonight. Well, I can't see him in there. I'm wondering if he's got any comments to make on this. No, can't see him in there. That's a shame. So I'm sure he would have something to say about this. Directly addressing Herbert Asquith, the reporter continues, "Mr. Prime Minister, I am not sure you are quite aware of the true state of affairs out here, or to what extent the generals keep you informed. Here in Gallipoli, we are dissipating a large part of the Empire's fortune and have not yet gained a single acre of ground of any strategic value. This futile expedition may ruin our prospects of wearing down Germany's colossal military power." So on top of, you know, this being a big catastrophe and being very embarrassing for Britain and costing a lot of lives, it was actually affecting the war effort as well elsewhere, because they were losing their resources in doing this. All their resources were directed on this pointless expedition in Turkey when it was needed to fight against Germany. And also, this makes us aware that this was actually being talked about in the newspapers. This was being known by the troops at home. So this would have, you know, this would have harmed morale amongst the British people and amongst the rest of the army.
Yeah, definitely.
What an embarrassment Churchill is.
Can't believe he around for as long as he was.
Well, finally we get to the death toll. And as I say, the death toll that you've got in the documentary, it says number of those killed varies, but it is estimated at around 150,000.
Yeah, that's the figure that they came out with the documentary we're using, yeah.
So we don't really know exactly how many. As I say, at the end of that, then you've got another little bit about the starvation blockade of Germany.
Well, in World War One, I thought we'd stick them together, you know.
Ah, right, yes, because obviously this would have happened like 3 years later, or 2 years later, 2 years after this, we get the starvation
another
of Germany.
Another great idea from Churchill.
By the end of the First World War, three great European Christian empires had been destroyed: Austria, Hungary, Germany, and Russia. Although Austria started World War One by declaring war on Serbia, it was Germany who would be singled out for punishment and reparations. I mean, that really doesn't make sense, does it, Dennis? I mean, as you pointed out earlier, Germany came in on the side of Austria because Russia came in on the side of Serbia.
Correct.
So if anybody, you know, it should have been Russia for coming in on the side of Serbia.
Well, they're never going to say that because they were on the side of Britain, but it certainly should have been Austria.
I mean, it should have just been Austria against... If Austria wants to declare war on Serbia, it should have just been Austria against Serbia.
Yeah, kind
of. Without other countries joining in. The war had ended in November 1918, but secretly, Germany was still under the Allied blockade, which was ruthlessly enforced with a media blackout. So even though the war has stopped and the treaty hasn't actually been signed, Germany has said, OK, we'll stop the war. And instead of lifting this blockade, they just continued to starve them.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, what was the point in, you know, saying you want to stop the war you give in, basically, if you're not going to, if they're not going to lift the blockade? And that's...
Well, they wanted to sign the Versailles Treaty and they wouldn't. So they decided to starve them to the table.
Right, so that played into it.
Yeah.
They wanted them to sign that. So they must have been, were they under this blockade before they sued for peace then?
Yeah, of course they were, yeah. They were under blockade during the war and then after the war. It never eased up. Because
right.
If you remember, in The Greatest Story Never Told, or even Secret Masonic Victory, I showed the German soldiers coming back to Germany and they were shocked on how the families were all starving and having to eat rats and kill horses.
According to the National Health Office in Berlin, 763,000 persons had already died as a result of the blockade at that time. So that was up until the end of the war. 763,000 died, right?
Yeah.
And this was followed by 900,000 Germans who died of starvation in 1918 and 1919. So even more died after the war than had died during the war of starvation. The starvation policy had begun in 1914, and Winston Churchill, one of the instigators of the scheme, admitted that it was aimed at, quote, starving the whole population, men, women and children, old and young, wounded and sound, into submission, close quote. Yet another example of a huge death toll occurring after a war had ended with this satanic empire. So it's not all about just winning the war as quickly as possible, is it? Because they continue it afterwards, at the end of it.
Yeah, just, things just, have changed. After World War One, things changed in warfare. All the nobility went out the window.
I think a lot of that was to do with Churchill. I mean, he set the...
I'm sure
he
were, yeah.
He set the standards with the Lusitania, didn't he?
Yeah, but, I mean, everything he did was the least noblest thing you can think of.
And I'd like to look at the other characters that we had around then and see whether any of them, you know, were still chivalrous or whether they followed this example, how honourable they were.
That'd be interesting, yeah. That would be interesting.
I mean, I've heard there was one, Wellington. He was supposed to be very good. I mean, I've been looking at some of the other characters from earlier, like Captain Cook and Admiral Bligh. They were all very, yeah, very honourable people. And even just now, I'm doing a little series looking at Shackleton, and he was very honourable and a good man. So we did still have good honourable men around at this time. It's just that they weren't in power.
The rules were being changed.
the Germans had the honourable man in power. The Germans had Adolf Hitler. They managed to get a good man in power. And we just had this devil Churchill, who this warmonger.
Devil is the word.
Yeah, well, you point out this satanic empire. And it was satanic. It was, you know, it was doing the opposite of what you would think a grouping of human beings working together would do. They weren't improving their lives.
I mean, when Churchill's coming out with these statements, he's not short of bragging about it.
Well, yeah, he was quite happy to kill all those Indians off, wasn't he?
Yeah, starve all the Indians. One or two things saying that he doesn't see why people get upset about gassing these Kurds.
Oh yeah, and the gassing, and he wanted to use the gassing again in the second war. I don't think he had any empathy. He is a classic psychopath, isn't it? That just has no empathy. No empathy at all.
I'm pretty sure there's a lot hidden as well about his own personal life, because he must have been a tortured soul in some way.
There's probably a lot that's hidden in the archives, you know, from the secret services.
Yeah, because Devon Institute, a Churchill Institution, I think, and that goes a long way to covering things up.
Yeah, like there's a myth, a legend that surrounds him.
Yeah, they keep that going, don't they?
I'd like to read David Irving's book one day when I get the time on Churchill. He's done I've seen a 2-hour speech of his.
Well, actually, it's strange because he mentions that although he's got some Jewish blood, that Churchill was never really forthcoming about being friendly to the Jews. But I found a documentary totally opposite to what David Irving says.
Well, he was bailed out by the Jews, wasn't he? Or by the focus group, which was predominantly Jews.
He was owned by the Jews from the word go, from his father.
How was that then, Dennis?
Well, I think even his father got into debts as well, and he was around Jews a lot, and they helped him. And obviously, Churchill couldn't have gone around the world on what he was earning at the time without any help. You know, when he was going to South Africa, so-called as a reporter, and then other places, he certainly had financial backing. And this documentary names the people behind him.
I think I remember Mr. I telling me that it was Jews that helped him get back into public life after this Gallipoli disaster with this focus group.
It's an asset to him.
Funding his campaign and pushing to have him accepted again.
Because he's going to do what he's told.
Yeah. Well, the Allies proceeded to confiscate German private property all over the world. Contrary to all precedent from previous wars, when private property had been held in escrow until the ratification of peace treaties, when it would revert to its legitimate owners. The Germans were even forced to relinquish their livestock, including their dairy cows, which were transported to France and Belgium, depriving the German children of milk. Now, I didn't know that. They took their property off them all over the world.
Yes.
How do you mean from the German colonies. Businesses or do you mean from individuals? The colonies. Yeah, that was taken from them. I was just thinking in terms of like individuals that were living in countries. I guess they would have been locked up as enemy aliens anyway, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
In camps or
somewhere along the way.
Well, the Treaty of Versailles was signed on June the 28th, 1919, and the food blockade ended on July the 12th, 1919. The total number of German civilians starved to death is 1,663,000. So, well, what was the actual date of when the war ended then, before this Versailles Treaty? Because the war ended in 1918, didn't it?
Yeah, I couldn't tell you the exact date off the top of my head. But obviously, it's gone on through 1918. And into 1819.
So it must have been at least 6 months or 8 months that the blockade continued.
I think about eight months.
So for another 8 months, the Germans were being starved to death after surrendering. That's really disappointing.
And the old world was unaware. This was all in a blackout.
Yeah, they kept a lot of stuff from the public during the war.
Yeah, well, like I was in a forum once, and they were saying, well, the Versace doesn't seem that bad, but they have no idea that the Germans were that bad. The Germans had to be starved to accept it.
It's disgusting. Well, at least we're talking about it today, and at least you're highlighting
it out there. Yeah, yeah.
In your documentaries. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Dennis.
Okay.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. Do remember that we require your donations to keep the website going. It's very easy to do. Just download an Electrum wallet, and then you can buy Bitcoin at local Bitcoin. You can buy it with PayPal. You can buy it with cash. All different ways you can buy it from local Bitcoin. It's very easy. You don't need to take photocopies of your passport or anything like that. You can just use PayPal. You can get £10 worth of Bitcoin. Then you just send it to your Bitcoin wallet, and then you send it from there to our Bitcoin wallet. It's a very simple, easy thing to do, and it's a way of letting us know that you appreciate what we're doing here. So thank you very much for listening. We will be back next Friday with more Truthful Out Radio for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.
RadioAlbion.com